From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On this edition of Fresh Air, we take a look at the women's health movement. We'll talk with two of the members of the Boston Women's Health Book Collective, which is celebrating its 20th anniversary. They're the women who wrote the groundbreaking book, Our Bodies Ourselves. And we'll discuss the special healthcare problems of African-American women with Billy Avery, executive director of the National Black Women's Health Project. Also today, art critic and philosopher Arthur Danto talks with us about art that provokes and disturbs. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the latest album from the controversial rap group Public Enemy. And film critic Owen Gleiberman checks out Back to the Future 3. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush announced today that he's extending China's most favored nation trade status for another year. It's a controversial decision. Many members of Congress had called on the president to end China's MFN status because of the crackdown on students and workers at Tiananmen Square and the repression that followed. More from NPR's Ted Clark.
The president stressed the economic reasons for extending China's most favored nation trading status, which guarantees the lowest possible tariffs for Chinese imports to the United States. If he ended China's MFN status, Mr. Bush said, Americans would pay 40% more for Chinese products. And he warned that China might retaliate by closing its market to American goods.
China buys about $6 billion a year of American aircraft and wheat and chemicals, lumber and other products. Lose this market, and we lose American jobs.
The president argued that an end to MFN would hurt the wrong people inside China. It would hurt ordinary citizens, he said, and the reformers in China who have used ties to the outside world to keep China on the path to modernization. But these arguments failed to quiet the president's critics on Capitol Hill, who accused Mr. Bush of being insensitive to human rights concerns. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev told a Lithuanian delegation today that the republic could achieve independence in a minimum of 2 years. But the Soviet president repeated his insistence that the Baltic states suspend its March 11th Declaration of Independence before talks begin. Benjamin Rowe has this report from Moscow.
Gorbachev's hour-long meeting with four Lithuanian legislators came a day after the republic's parliament voted to suspend all its post-independence laws during any talks with Moscow. One of the delegates present, Nikolai Medvedev, told NPR afterwards that Gorbachev ruled out lifting the economic sanctions against Lithuania without a concession from the breakaway Baltic state. According to Medvedev, Gorbachev said that otherwise the citizens of the USSR would not understand, especially the military. But the Lithuanian lawmaker added that Gorbachev did tell the delegation that the republic could achieve independence earlier than the five-year framework outlined in the country's tough new secession law, but that required a freeze of its March 11th proclamation. The delegation will bring the offer back to Vilnius, where up until now, the Lithuanian parliament has refused to consider modifying its independence vote. For National Public Radio, I'm Benjamin Rowe in Moscow.
President Bush exercised his first veto of the year today, using it to block a bill authorizing money for Amtrak, the nation's passenger rail service. The president objected to a provision in the bill that would have required government approval for acquisitions of railroads by non-railroad companies. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped 0.71 to close at 2,855.55. Declines edged advances in active trading. This is NPR News. The U.S. Senate struck down an amendment today that would have prohibited the death penalty in cases where racial bias was a determining factor. The proposal was part of a larger anti-crime bill that expands the use of the federal death penalty to 30 new offenses. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold has this report.
A General Accounting Office report required by the 1988 drug bill found that 82% of all studies examined showed that people who murder whites are more likely to be sentenced to death than those who murder blacks. Senator Kennedy, sponsor of the Racial Justice Act, says there's also evidence that blacks are more likely to be sentenced to death than whites.
We are obviously divided about whether or not there should be a federal death penalty at all, but all of us are united in the belief that racial considerations can and should play no role whatsoever in the decision of who shall live and who shall die.
But opponents of the measure, who say it will force quotas and wipe out the death penalty altogether, succeeded in striking it from the overall anti-crime bill. Senate Democrats won an earlier round prohibiting the use of the death penalty against mentally retarded persons convicted of capital crimes. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
The Navy today reopened its investigation into the last year's gun turret explosion that killed 47 sailors aboard the battleship Iowa. Navy investigators concluded last year that the Iowa explosion was most probably an intentional act by Clayton Hartwig, a member of the gun crew who was allegedly committing suicide. Earl Hartwig, the accused man's father, said he felt vindicated by the Navy's decision.
I say that this is what we as a family have been saying all along. The Navy was wrong, that there was no detonator or chemical device used, and it had to be some type of accident.
The Navy today ordered a halt to the firing of all 16-inch guns aboard Navy battleships. The order was prompted by an explosion today in what officials said was follow-up testing since the Iowa blast. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The women's health care movement can take a lot of the credit for the acceptance of natural childbirth and for allowing partners in the delivery room, for the legalization of abortion, and many other changes. But perhaps one of its greatest achievements has been helping women feel more knowledgeable about, at ease with, and in control of their bodies. A book that helped launch the women's health movement is Our Bodies Ourselves. It was perhaps the first book about women's bodies written for women, by women, from a feminist perspective. It was written by the Boston Women's Health Book Collective, which is celebrating its 20th anniversary. In its early stages, the movement was largely a white, middle-class phenomenon. A little later in our program, we'll meet one of the women who has extended the movement to the needs of black women. First, we have two of the early members of the Boston Women's Health Book Collective, Esther Rome and Nancy Hawley. Nancy is one of the organizers of the collective and now is a board member. Esther came to the first meeting of the collective and still is a member. The group first met to discuss the women's frustrations with doctors. Nancy remembers some of the frustrations she experienced with her gynecologist at the time.
My first child was born in Ann Arbor, and that was in the summer of 1966. And it was the head of the women's hospital who was my physician at that time. And my husband and I went to a Lamaze class. Now, he thought that was kind of cute, that I and my husband would be interested in learning that much and in doing a preparing for childbirth and possibly considering not using any drugs unless there was some reason. And I know that after I gave birth to my son without drugs and had used the skills I had learned in the class taught by a woman, that we were still considered kind of unique, and he kind of patted me on the head and said, "That's very sweet of you, that you could do that."
Esther, what about you?
Well, one of the things that happened to me early on was at the time in the late 60s, birth control was illegal for unmarried women in Massachusetts, and of course abortion was illegal. And I went to, happened to be connected with university, so I went to the University Health Services, and it was a week before I was getting married, and I said I wanted to be fitted for a diaphragm, and the doctor looked at me and said, "Come back after you're married." And I said, "Well, what am I supposed to do till then?"
You know, Esther and I have never talked about this, Terry, but I had an identical experience in Ann Arbor.
Oh, really?
And what they said to me at the time, they would give it to me before if I could bring in an engagement announcement. Now, we weren't doing a wedding like that. I didn't have an engagement announcement from a newspaper. And I finally convinced the nurse to get, the nurse helped me out.
Well, I also knew some women in college who had to go to Puerto Rico or other places for abortions.
Mm-hmm.
So it was it wasn't easy to take care of sexual and reproductive needs at that time in an open way as a woman.
Well, you know, I know one of the things that interested me when I first started reading Our Bodies Ourselves was that you had photographs in there of women's bodies, of women's bodies pregnant, of women's bodies having, you know, in childbirth, of women and men and women having sexual relations. And, you know, in all kinds of, like, health books in the past, what you got to see was that reproductive diagram, you know, with the two ovaries.
Right,
the
right. No, tubes. No heads, right?
Yeah. Well, it was just, you know, like some, like,
not stick figure, but like an illustration with just a little bit of anatomy in circles, right? The fallopian tubes, the ovaries. And like there were like real women, and you could look at your bodies and look at their bodies and realize, well, this is what bodies are like. And I think for women at that time, there was still this sense of down there, this sense of kind of mystery, sense of somewhat embarrassment about your own body. Is that one of the things you were trying to like work against, you know, try to do away with?
Well, one of the things I want to say, you're saying that they were women's bodies. We were very conscious of the fact that we wanted to portray women, and sometimes they had their clothes on and sometimes they didn't, but we were very careful in most cases not to fragment the bodies in the picture, that we wanted whole people as much as possible.
And not fashion models either.
That's right.
Let me ask you what you think some of the greatest accomplishments of the women's healthcare movement have been in the past 20 years.
Oh, I go back and forth about that because sometimes it feels like we're still running in place.
Mm-hmm.
I think that there's certainly a greater acknowledgement among some doctors that women are really interested in what's going on and they are willing to be partners with women. Now, medical education hasn't changed that much, so doctors are still educated in a much more authoritarian manner, but some of the doctors who get through medical school are still able to work with their clients, really, not so much patients. There are certainly many more women going to medical school today, but the numbers of women alone without changes in attitude is not really sufficient to change health and medical care.
You know, one of the things I was thinking about is that in the past 20 years, so much has changed, a lot for the better, some for the worse. But one area that seems to have changed very little is birth control. I mean, I can't really think of a really popular, widely used form of birth control that has entered the repertory since the Boston Women's Health Collective was organized back in the late 60s. I know there's the cervical cap, but I wonder, like, how many women really use it?
Well, part of the problem with the cervical cap has to do with distribution, and there's political problems with setting up distribution for that. Part of the problem, I think, is that there's been very little research on new barrier methods of birth control. Most of the research has gone into various kinds of hormonal contraceptives. They are being tested in other countries, but they haven't really met the safety standards in this country, which frankly could be better than they are even. Another thing, too, is you have to look at the economics of birth control. Birth control pills are highly profitable. A woman needs to take one, you know, every day or nearly every day of her cycle. There's repeat sales. And the profits are great enough that the companies can cover the lawsuits that they get. One of the problems with the IUD is that you don't have a lot of repeat sales. There's only so much you can charge per item, and the profit wasn't high enough to cover the lawsuits. Now, you can say that you need a product which doesn't have so many lawsuits attached to it, and that would be a better product.
My guests are Nancy Hawley and Esther Rome, who have both been involved with the Boston Women's Health Book Collective since its beginnings, and the collective is celebrating its 20th anniversary. What would you say is the greatest setback in recent years to the women's health movement?
Oh, the abortion issue. Definitely the abortion issue. I mean, the fact is, I remember demonstrations in the early 70s. I remember one that I helped organize, which was the first demonstration against, supporting the right for women to have abortion, and abortion was still illegal in the state. And I remember a number of friends having to go to New York to get legal abortions. And we made such progress. And now we're in a very difficult time, and it really feels like, it feels awful that the funds that we have to use to reinstate rights and improve upon the rights that we fought for so hard in the early 70s. I think that's the hardest one that I see.
I also see the poverty playing a very large role in the disintegration of health, particularly of women and children.
I think, you know, also when you talk about poverty, I think about drugs, and I think about there wasn't even the awareness of the of what the effects of alcohol and other kind of drugs would have on us as women and as childbearing women, and the prevalence of drug abuse, the prevalence of child and sexual abuse. I mean, those were things, alcoholism, we were not even aware of. They're not even mentioned in the first book, any of those issues. And the whole topic of women and alcoholism became a chapter, a section of a chapter in a book because people had written to us and raised concerns.
Mm-hmm. What's kept the collective together for 20 years?
Well, I spoke about this at our recent celebration party on the 13th. And I think what kept us together is what got us started in the beginning, that we came together for both personal and work and political reasons. And that powerful combination of really being able to love your work and work with your friends has kept us together, because there's so many ways in which our lives weave together. I mean, we raised children together, we ran play groups together, we wrote books together, we gave workshops together, we celebrated weddings, we grieved over the loss of parents, we went through divorces together, we've gone through menopause together.
Some of us.
And I think the combination of those experiences has kept us really connected, even if we don't see each other all the time.
Nancy, Esther, I wish you both a happy anniversary, and thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Esther Rome and Nancy Hawley of the Boston Women's Health Book Collective. Coming up, more about the women's health movement from Billy Avery, the founder of the National Black Women's Health Project. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Billy Avery got involved in the women's health movement in the 1970s around the issue of abortion. Then in 1978, she co-founded an alternative birthing center. But in 1980, she worked at a community college where some of the students were teenage mothers. Hearing the young women talk about their lives, she felt the women's health movement wasn't successfully addressing the needs of black women. So she founded the National Black Women's Health Project, a community-based self-help program headquartered in Atlanta. Last year, she won a grant from the MacArthur Foundation, the grant more commonly known as the Genius Award. I asked Billy Avery how the health problems of African-American women compare to those of white women.
All of the things that's on one's list will be on the other's list. It's just that how we prioritize them will be differently. We have to take into the analysis the effects of racism, sexism, classism on the lives of African-American women. When we as African-American women got together to start talking about the realities of our lives, one of the things we first noticed is that many of us have lived in the midst of a lot of violence, and it affects us in a myriad of ways. Violence, which is something that we all are forced to live with, is one of those things that the psychological hook must be first dealt with before one can physically remove herself from that type of situation. It is a primary, number one, mental health issue, and we can't expect to do anything about physical health if the mental health is not in good shape.
We talk about mental health. You've mentioned in things that you've written that you think stress is actually a crucial issue for many black women, and that it might manifest itself in different ways than it might, say, among many white women.
Oh, absolutely. When you look at the types of environments that we live in, mm-hmm. the types of, I can remember moving from one side of town to the other and feeling my entire body start to relax. There isn't a one of us in this country who is safe from danger. And you just think about how tense you feel when you're in a situation that is very taxing. Well, for most of us as black women, we are on all the time. We have to be aware of this. We have to watch out for this. We have to consider this. And when you think of all these things, all these factors that we have to consider just to be able to function and survive, it's very taxing on the physical and the mental body.
I imagine part of what you try to do with your group is consciousness raising and education. What are the biggest issues that you're trying to educate around now?
What we do is we ask each woman to look at her life and to look at those factors affecting her life. And then she makes a decision individually about what things she wants to work on. Then as a national organization, we usually make an assessment as to what is going on out there in the world and what are those factors that are affecting us at that moment. Right now, the factors around reproductive health issues are pressing ones. There is the abortion struggle. There is the fact that blacks have high infant mortality statistics. There's the fact that many women over the ages of 35 have had hysterectomies because of the presence of fibroids. So, you know, reproductive health issues are really real for us, not to mention AIDS and not to mention substance abuse and sterilization abuse.
You didn't mention teen pregnancy, and I wonder what kind of work you're doing around that or if you see that as an important issue.
Yeah, it is, but it's certainly one that we as a country is not doing very well at, you know? We were just in one of our meetings the other day saying that we should really stop addressing teen pregnancy.
What?
That we should talk about young women's issues.
Uh-huh.
What are the things that young women are faced with, or which pregnancy is one of them? Since we don't seem to be doing very much at reducing these numbers because society is unwilling to put in place real incentives. I mean, realistic incentives. What if all the money that's being spent on teen pregnancy programs was divided up among young girls and said, well, you know, when you finish school, this is what you can do. This is a real job for you, paying real money, you know, so that people can have some hope and gather some strength around the competition of peer pressure, drugs, et cetera. You know, it's a very difficult issue.
So how would you change that? I mean, how would you address other...
Well, one of the things
how would you be more relevant to teenagers?
Right. One of the things that we've done is we produced a film called On Becoming a Woman, Mothers and Daughters Talking Together. And we learned that what is missing in most families is the ability of parents and their young people to communicate about sex, about birth control, about sexuality. We've learned from our young people that they want to hear this information from our parents. And quite frankly, most of us have absolutely no idea how to start talking to our young people about this.
You say that most teenagers want to hear about birth control and about sex and
sexuality.
Reproduction from their mothers. But what do you think about teaching this in the schools?
I think it's fine to teach it in the schools.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yes. I'm not saying not to teach it in the schools, but certainly the parents need to know how to share. I think that most of the programs are geared just for the teens. But the programs, I think, would even prosper more if they left the teens alone and geared them toward the parents.
That's interesting.
Because, yeah, we'd be putting in place a model that could last throughout the generations.
The black community has been particularly hard hit by AIDS. What kind of work do you feel that you can do that would be effective?
Work with each and every individual woman to learn how to effectively take care of herself so that she will have the courage and the nerve to insist on her sexual partners, knowing all that they can do about prevention and taking those steps, because it takes a lot of nerve to stand up to a person and say, well, I don't want to be with you unless you are willing to protect both of us all the times around AIDS. And the strength and the methodology for doing that is also relevant to all of the other sexually transmitted diseases. And it is within the core of one's empowerment and taking charge of her life.
Have you encountered any resistance on the part of the black women who you're trying to organize and educate, or are mostly people very receptive to the messages that you're bringing?
Oh, people are pretty receptive. I would say 99% of the folks are very perceptive. And see, for many women, they say this is the first time in their lives that anybody has ever said that we as black women are wonderful, we are powerful, that we deserve to have the very best in life that there is, just by the mere fact that we were born into this world. That type of validation doesn't come every day. And that is one of the things that the women appreciate, I would say, the most. It gets them on the road to understanding that, yes, I am right. I deserve to have it. And, you know, it's for me. It's a different kind of message.
A lot of the women's issues that you're organizing around have to do with reproductive health and reproductive rights. In the issue of black men's health, mm-hmm. What would you see as the main issues to organize around?
I think they need to organize around violence, because homicide, the whole hydra-headed oppression, the whole anger turned inward, that makes people destroy themselves as well as each other, is a number one problem. But it all has to do with how this society has cast black men and how they see themselves and what they see reflected in each other.
When you were younger, before you were an activist,
mm-hmm.
did you feel like you had control over your health care at all? Were there any very bad experiences in your life?
No, the fact of it is I hadn't thought about health that way much at all. You know, I sort of left my life up to the doctors to take care of us, you know, and that, you know, you can do whatever you want to do. I wasn't aware of the statistics. I wasn't aware of being knowledgeable of consent of anything. There was not any awareness, to tell you the truth. I had two babies, and I wanted to be knocked out cold, and I wanted to make sure if that doctor couldn't get there, one who could knock me out could do it. And, you know, I just sort of blindly went through the healthcare system, trusting.
And what ended the trust?
Well, it's not that the trust is ended. It's just that I go through it now as a much more knowledgeable person, as a person who feels on equal footing and knows that I have a right to control and know about my body, and also know that I can talk to healthcare providers and have them to understand that as I become a more knowledgeable consumer, that makes our partnership more powerful and that it promotes health and healing. That I do know that I can do.
Billy Avery, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Billy Avery is the executive director of the National Black Women's Health Project. She's also contributed a chapter to the Black Women's Health book, Speaking for Ourselves, which has just been published by Seal Press. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer, providing the Fresh Air staff the power to be their best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, we talk about art, art that provokes and disturbs, with Arthur Danto. He's an art critic and philosopher. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Fear of a Black Planet, the new album by the rap group Public Enemy. They're a group that's been controversial for anti-Semitic comments. Ken says they've also made a brilliant album. And film critic Owen Gleiberman reviews Back to the Future 3. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. The Navy has ordered a halt to the firing of all 16-inch guns on board all U.S. battleships after the unexplained ignition of bags of powder during testing today. The Navy's testing was related to last year's explosion on board the USS Iowa. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
The Navy has reopened its investigation into the Battleship Iowa explosion and put all 16-inch guns out of commission because of surprise ignition today during testing at the Naval Surface Warfare Center in Virginia. A Navy spokesman says no one was injured in the ignition and the order is a safety precaution. The Navy's been conducting periodic tests as a follow-up to the USS Iowa explosion as new theories emerged about what triggered the blast. The Navy said last year the Iowa explosion was most probably an intentional act by the ship's gunner's mate, Clayton Hartwig. But members of Congress called that conclusion ridiculous and unfounded and have cited the Navy's investigation as flawed. Ohio Senator Howard Metzenbaum, a vocal critic of the Navy's findings, referred to an unreleased General Accounting Office report today that he says concludes there was no evidence against Hartwig and that the gun could have exploded as a result of powder being over-rammed into the barrel. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
Soviet leader Gorbachev has reportedly offered to call off economic sanctions against Lithuania if it suspends its declaration of independence. According to a Lithuanian journalist, the Soviet president said that he does not oppose the Baltic Republic leaving the Soviet Union, but that this will take several years. And first, a declaration of independence must be frozen. With hundreds and perhaps thousands of nuclear warheads due for destruction under arms control agreements, 54 prominent scientists and diplomats are appealing to President Bush and Soviet leader Gorbachev to halt the production of nuclear weapons ingredients to save billions of dollars and for safety's sake. Barry Schweid has more.
Their suggestion is to recover the plutonium and tritium for new nuclear weapons from old warheads. Unless the U.S. and the Soviet Union accelerate the arms race, and that isn't planned, there would be enough in the way of nuclear ingredients to keep pace as old weapons are destroyed. The Bush administration plans to reopen the nuclear reactor plant at Savannah River, South Carolina, in January. The Soviet Union is in production. Signers of the appeal for a halt at the summit included a former Secretary of State, Cyrus Vance, former Defense Secretary Robert McNamara, former CIA Directors William Colby and Stansfield Turner, and seven Nobel laureates. For National Public Radio, this is Barry Schweid in Washington.
In New York City on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down less than 1 point today to close at 2,855.55 on volume of 155 million shares. Trading was light as declining issues edged out advances. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Ever since the release 2 years ago of Public Enemy's album It Takes a Nation of Millions to Hold Us Back, the rap group has been at the center of the controversy over rap music. Public Enemy has a new album called Fear of a Black Planet. Rock critic Ken Tucker has this review.
Yo, move on to the battle zone, get the black mind back.
They just hope that he'll never wake up because they never want to meet him on the battlefield.
War, 33 in the third, haven't you heard? I got quick, they clever at the level of a scientist. Wit, fist, lift, mind, fist, pump, jump, and don't miss. So I'm a darn in grudge against the enemy and any other nigga with an attitude. See, and any other rapper who's a brother trying to speak to one another. Same, I don't give a damn. Look at the
major editors from Emerald City.
Public Enemy's leader,
Tree Standish.
Wow.
Tree Standish.
Chuck D.
Wow. Tree Standish.
Fear of a Black Planet is the first rap album to sell more than a million copies in the first week of its release. This would seem to be as much a measure of Public Enemy's notoriety as of its musical accomplishments. The group continues to be dogged by the anti-Semitic statements made in a newspaper interview last year by the group's so-called Minister of Information, who's now left the Public Enemy organization. The debate about this incident will, and should, go on for a long time. In the meantime, Public Enemy has returned with another amazing feat of record making.
Going, going, gone. Now I dialed 911 a long time ago. But don't you see how late they're reacting? They only come and they come when they wanna. So get the morgue truck and then bomb the corner. They don't care because they stay paid anyway. They treat you like an ace that can't beat the tray. I know you stumble with no use people. If your life is on the line, then you're dead today. Latecomers with the latecomers stretcher. That's a body bag in disguise, y'all. I'll bet ya. I call them body snatchers because they come to fetch you with an autopsy ambulance just to dissect ya. They are the kings because they swing amputations. Lose your arms, your legs, and limbs compilation. I can prove it to you, watch the rotation. It all adds up to a fucking situation. So get up and get down. 911 is joking, yo, town. Get up and get down. Late 911, where's the late crown?
That's the album's first single, 911 is a Joke. Public Enemy sees itself as a political band intent on depicting life in the ghetto. In that song, the idea is that dialing the emergency number in what might be called an emergency neighborhood won't get you much help very quickly. More broadly, Public Enemy is advocating a renewal of 60s activism. Another song here is called Power to the People, for example. But unlike so much political pop, Public Enemy's version of it isn't drearily earnest and self-righteous. It is instead a form of musical debate. There's a chaotic clatter to everything, the music, the lyrics, their sentiments. All the elements in a Public Enemy record seem to be arguing with themselves. And that's an aesthetic decision as much as it is a political one.
Crucifixion ain't no fiction. So-called chosen, frozen, apology made to whoever pleases. Still, he got me like Jesus. I'd rather sing, bring, think, reminisce. Bound a brother while I'm in sync. Every brother ain't a brother. Cause a color just as well could be undercover. Backstab, grab the flag from the back of the lab. Told the rap, get off the rag. Sad to say, I got sold down the river. Still some quiver when I deliver. Never to say, I never knew or had a clue. Word was heard plus hard on the boulevard. Lies, scandalizing, facing. Treats of hate who celebrate with sin. I rope a dope the evil with righteous bobbing and weaving. And let the good get even. Come on down. But welcome to the Terror Dome.
Come on down.
Public Enemy's lyrics are declaimed by Chuck D, whose deep, booming voice is surprisingly supple, and it certainly needs to be to deliver Public Enemy's quick, choppy lines. Most rap music is written in rhyming couplets of conversational length, take a breath, start a new line. But like everything else about this group's music, Chuck D's words are quicker and the rhymes come faster. And all around him, the production team of Eric Sadler and Hank and Keith Shockley is piling up snippets of music, bits of other people's songs, voices sampled from TV and radio. This forms a sonic collage that's far more intense and complex than that of any other rap act. You can hear all of this on Who Stole the Soul.
Once again, this is it, turn it up. Here we go, but this time the rap's gonna ask who did the crime. Then let's get down to the nitty-gritty. I wanna know if Big Wilson pocket after he rocked it, backed it, shocked it. Same kind of thing they threw at James. And what they did, the red was a shame. The bigger the black get, the bigger the feds want a piece of that. Intentional rape system like we ain't paid enough in this bitch. That's why I diss them. I learned we earned, got no concern. Instead we're burned. Where the hell is our return? Plain and simple, the system's a pimp. But I refuse to be a hoe. Who stole the soul?
On another song here, Chuck D yells, "I got so much trouble on my mind," and he's not talking only about Public Enemy's PR problems. Public Enemy takes seriously its role as artists out to create something new from the traditions of African-American pop music. Unlike so many acts around just now, who feel it's enough to merely quote from James Brown or Sly Stone or George Clinton, Public Enemy wants to both acknowledge an artistic debt and extend that tradition. They're making difficult, innovative music that nonetheless manages to find a large, eager audience. On those terms, Fear of a Black Planet is a great success.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly.
I get down on what it is, and if it ain't funky,
yeah,
see ya. People asking me what's going on in my mind. Wait a minute.
This is Fresh Air. Arthur Danto is a professor of philosophy at Columbia University. He's also the art critic for The Nation magazine. He says he writes philosophy for philosophers and walks the art galleries as a spectator, but the happiest moments of his life are those in which he exists on both planes simultaneously. Danto has a new collection of essays reflecting on the state of the art world from his unique perspective as both critic and philosopher. He says the nearest thing to a philosophical genius the art world has produced is Andy Warhol.
I thought that every move he made as an artist was somehow that raised a philosophical question and raised it with a vividness.
Questions like, what is art and what's the difference between art and advertising?
Well,
art and
well, art and mere reality.
Yeah, right.
Things of that sort. He raised, when he did movies, the basic philosophical questions about moving images, it seems to me, by, for example, making films in which there was no movement at all. And you immediately say, well, in what sense are those movies? And nobody really had ever tried raise those questions before. And I thought he was an intuitive philosopher. But my interest in Warhol was from that. And the impact he made on me at one point where I've often written about it and probably did in this book too, a great exhibition at the Stable Gallery in 1964 where he just showed those Brillo boxes, and I found that absolutely astonishing. And it was the first time I'd ever seen anything as a philosopher that raised a philosophical question about art. I mean, there were the old questions about resemblance and imitation and so forth, but it didn't seem to me to go very deeply into anybody's understanding of art. And here was Warhol suddenly raising the question, why is this a work of art, though something that looks exactly like it isn't one? It's just a, what I call a mere thing. The fact that finally it was possible to think philosophically about art in a way that directly connected the philosophy of art with the practice of it.
You've coined the word disturbational to describe a certain kind of art. Explain why you needed to coin that word.
Well, I was thinking at that time about some very, very marginal art, performance art primarily. At least it was marginal through the history of art. It was not just a depiction of disturbing things. A lot of art's that. Leon Golub is an artist who shows people being tortured, and that's extremely disturbing. But I was interested in those kinds of artists who confront an audience and try and create in confrontation with the audience a sort of transformative experience, almost operating like priests and priestesses did in very ancient times. I used the word disturbation, as I say in the book, as a kind of natural rhyme to masturbation, where you begin with images and fantasies, and you get real spasms. that is to And that's what you start at. You start with something which is set apart. It takes place in an art gallery. It's institutional. And if the performance succeeds, lives have been transformed in consequence of it. And I think that marginal as it is, it's very important. And it recovers something that had been lost sight of, I think, in the history of art. I think it was there very much at the beginning, but we've become such formalists, so much interested in questions of color and composition and abstraction, that art had distanced itself considerably from life. And I thought that this form of disturbation was an effort, at any rate, to reconnect art with life, and I rather applauded that.
Let me ask you about the work of Robert Mapplethorpe, who's become probably the most controversial artist because of all the attempts to censor shows of his work. You reviewed his 1988 show at the Whitney, and you wrote, this wasn't an easy experience, but a crucial one.
Yes.
Can you give us a sense of what you find so important and valuable about Mapplethorpe's work?
Well, Mapplethorpe was alive when that show went up. He made decisions as to what could and couldn't be in that show. And that Mapplethorpe, at the edge of death by AIDS, should have wanted those photographs of sadomasochist couples or practices, as he photographed, to be in that show. Meant to me that he wanted them to be taken seriously, that some kind of a statement was being made, and that a viewer or a reviewer had an obligation to try and see what that statement was and to respond to it in some way. It was a brilliantly installed exhibition. You found yourself at the far corner from the entrance, suddenly surrounded by these very difficult images, morally difficult images, images of practices that were a bit scary. There was Mapplethorpe, and he said, "You've got to pay attention to these paintings, these photographs. You've really got to think about them." And that's why I thought it was crucial. I thought there it was. I mean, AIDS was getting to be very definitely the one of the moral cruxes of our era, and that it was so easy to stigmatize people who suffer from it, and it went well beyond anything I think that Mapplethorpe had in mind when he made those photographs for a much smaller audience than saw them at the Whitney, and went much beyond what I think he thought of himself as doing in his project as a photographer throughout his life. He was very fashionable photographer, very glamorous photographer. But there, at the end of his life and in those circumstances, I think he had a certain authority. And I felt that the show had a meaning in excess of the particular images that were in it.
Many of the people trying to censor artworks or to restrict funding to artists who use controversial subject matter or sexual subject matter or homosexual subject matter. These people are saying, why should taxpayers support things that some people find obscene or that some people feel is offensive? What's your answer to that question?
My view is that issues of taste don't enter into the definition of the taxpayer at all. That's to say, the taxpayer is a civic category, somebody who supports a government. The only interest a taxpayer, as a taxpayer, has is in civic virtues like freedom. I don't think that we can go into questions of taste because every taxpayer has different tastes. And if we're going to have art at all, and then we come to the question of should it be subsidized through the NEA, then I think you've got to accept the fact that somebody might be offended.
What's your guess about why now? there's been such an attack on controversial art. I mean, let's face it. There are so many artists who would just die to have their work seen. Do you know what I mean?
Sure.
There's so much of the most controversial art basically went unnoticed outside of a few magazines and art magazines. And suddenly people who don't usually go to art galleries at all are protesting certain forms of art. Why is this happening now?
All of this is quite external. It's come up because of Mr. Helms. I think that had the Corcoran not called public attention, or one might say senatorial attention, to this exhibition, nothing would have happened. It would have gone on. I don't think most of the people in Congress go in to art museums. I don't think they've got a deep interest. But suddenly, attention was called to it, and a lot of noise got made. I think it's an electoral issue. I don't think it's an aesthetic issue. I don't even think it's a moral issue. I think it's a lot of hoopla.
You mean it's people politically exploiting the issue?
Yeah, that's what I think.
Mm-hmm. When you leave a show and you find yourself just agitated by something, is that good, you know, that you've been provoked? Is that...
Oh, I hope so, uh-huh. Yeah. Right. I mean, I don't think you just go to shows for the pleasure that you have while you're in them. I mean, like looking at floral bouquets or something. And I think that the art of the present moment is very provocative that way. But it's also should always have been provocative when you think about it. A lot of the powerful images of the past have sort of receded into the decorative scheme. But people should be pretty stirred by scenes of martyrdom. People should be pretty stirred by crucifixions. Should be pretty stirred by annunciations when you think about what it means if you happen to be a believing Christian. So I think art has mostly always been something that should leave you a bit reflective about something beyond the images themselves.
Well, Arthur Danto, thank you very much.
Thank you, Tara.
Arthur Danto's new collection of essays, Encounters and Reflections, is published by Farrar, Straus, Giroux. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what they've got for us on All Things Considered. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry. Today we'll have news of President Bush's decision to continue most favored nation status to China, People's Republic of China. It means that they'll be able to send goods here with the lowest possible tariffs. Very controversial move in Congress, where many felt that because of Tiananmen Square last year and repressions since, Chinese should not continue to enjoy those trade terms. We'll also be hearing about the elections in Colombia and the anatomy of a car crash. As the Memorial Day weekend is about to start, we look at a study of automobile accidents in the state of Maryland.
Thanks, Robert. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Robert Zemeckis and Steven Spielberg have gotten the third installment of Back to the Future out in record time, less than a year after Back to the Future 2. Guest film critic Owen Gleiberman wonders if they've gone Back to the Future one time too many.
Director Robert Zemeckis must have felt exhausted from all that hurtling back and forth along the space-time continuum that Michael J. Fox did in Back to the Future Part 2. In Back to the Future Part 3, Zemeckis simply plops down Marty McFly and Doc Brown in the Old West and leaves them there. This last installment in the series is also the first dud. More than anything, it recalls all those baby boomer sitcoms like Bewitched and The Partridge Family that featured an Old West episode. The movie trots out all the campy cliches. Cowboys gallop through Monument Valley to the beat of thumping Ponderosa music. Marty's nemesis, the bullying Biff Tannen, shows up as Mad Dog Tannen, a black-hatted gunslinger who fires bullets at Marty's feet and makes him dance. There are agitated Indians, a square dance, and a climactic shootout that's a dim retread of spaghetti westerns. As parody, this stuff was all done to death years ago on Bugs Bunny and in Blazing Saddles. This time, Marty McFly is more of a bystander. It's Doc who's the main character. He's seen his tombstone in the future, and now he's trying to change the course of history to avoid being shot and killed. He also falls in love with a pretty schoolmarm, played by Mary Steenburgen.
Emmett, do you think we'll ever be able to travel to the moon the way we travel across the country on trains?
Definitely. Although not for another 84 years and not on trains. We'll have space vehicles, capsules settle off with rockets, devices that create giant explosions. Explosions so powerful that they
They break the pull of the Earth's gravity and send the projectile through outer space. Damn it. I read that book, too. You're quoting Jules Verne, From the Earth to the Moon.
You've read Jules Verne.
I adore Jules Verne.
So do I.
Christopher Lloyd is a very funny character actor, but he's best in small doses. He wears out his welcome here, especially when the movie treats us to endless scenes of Doc Brown's ranting metaphysics. The truth is, there's barely a spark of life left in this material. Back to the Future 3 doesn't have a trace of the cross-generational urgency that made the original Back to the Future a pop classic. And it lacks the manic invention that made Part 2 fitfully entertaining, if overwrought. The movie's time travel logic also seems shakier than ever. After all, if Doc's tombstone says he died in 1885, how could he have ever invented the time machine that first brought him back to 1885? Oh well, the Planet of the Apes sequels never made much sense either. Here, though, the slipshod plotting results from Zemeckis desperately trying to end the series with an upbeat message. The first Back to the Future was rigorously deterministic. It held fast to the idea that one tiny event could alter your destiny, for better or worse. Part 3 is full of sappy homilies about how the future is what you make it. In other words, as long as you try hard enough, everything will turn out just fine. With this film, Robert Zemeckis continues his depressing transition from movie maker to glorified mechanic. Back to the Future 3 will probably gross $150 million at the box office, but the magic of this series is long gone, and so is the fun.
Owen Globerman is film critic for Entertainment Weekly. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman, Thad Kirk, Dan Lachlan, and Richard Parker. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, economist Robert Reich tells us to stop worrying about how competitive American business is, and he suggests some things we should worry about instead. Also, we talk with drummer Tony Williams. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.